Hey everyone, this is your host, Dr. Ryan McConnell, an assistant professor in the physical therapy program at Belmont University. I invite you to join me in gaining worldly advice through weekly episodes on all the PT hot topics that would interest you at any level of training. Welcome to Spilling the DPT. Hey everybody, this is going to be my attempt at telling my story. So I had a bunch of requests a long time ago about what it was like to be an educator or how I even got on that track in general. And it's taken me several months at this point in time, I'd say, where you've all heard a period of silence. And now I finally gathered my thoughts enough to put together this episode. My thought was, however, to maybe make this several different episodes and really just get a start at it and hopefully shed some light on my story. So for those of you wondering why I was so quiet over the last several months, well, just a few things on my agenda. I recently got married, we had a honeymoon, and then we had a little vacation with our family afterwards, and all of which has ended now, which has got me back on track for this podcast. So the first episode back, I want to make sure that I cover the thing that we last talked about, which is, so you want to be an educator. So I've got a series of questions that were asked of me last time I posted on Instagram, and wanted to go through those and answer them one at a time and hopefully get a chance to elaborate on them with future episodes. So the first big question I think that anybody would have on their mind as you look at this title is, well, what's my story and who am I and what is everything that the accumulation of my career, how has it added up to become an assistant professor at a university in Nashville? So the first thing I would say is, coming out of school, well, we'll give you a little background. So for those of you that are listening, I'm now going on my 9th year as a clinician or just as a physical therapist in general. And I went to a school out of Memphis called University of Tennessee, and it was their Health Science Center in Memphis. So UTHSC for those of you alumni. And before that, I was an undergraduate in University of Tennessee system as well, exercise science. And I would say all the while I knew that I was going to be in med school, I really liked learning. I did not like the discipline of studying or putting in extra work. I can go ahead and say that there for those of you that feel like I may have just been an overachiever all my life and I just wanted to learn. That was not the case. I wanted to make good grades, and I still don't know why, but I did like learning or being in the classroom. So after I graduated PT school, the biggest thing that I realized is that I had enough in the bank, in the knowledge bank, to really be able to treat effectively. I wouldn't maybe even call it effectively, but be able to treat for a week or two of a very simple condition like a knee replacement, a shoulder problem, or something in general orthopedic that we took extensive notes on in school. And within that time frame, I realized that there was a ton of gaps in my knowledge base that, whether you want to call it public school, me not paying attention, or a million different things, I think it's just a fundamental flaw in education and clinical education specifically. And so from that, I basically was seeking, I guess, additional training to fill those knowledge gaps. And I went through Maitland seminars, and I'm not advocating necessarily for one particular track in general, but I did find that that helped me extensively realize that having some sort of foundation that was more than just a broad generalist was going to be super helpful. So beyond that, I started an 18-month residency program in orthopedics, and that's where I started asking questions through that. It's like, this is great. I wish that I knew all of this stuff while I was in school, or I wish that I had gotten some of this while I was in school, and I would have felt more prepared. So overall, I would say I felt more confident, and I recognized that I really liked the material. Again, I didn't like the discipline part of it. And so I started asking questions of my instructors during that time. And I said, you know, hey, how do I get this question answered? Like, I want to know when I should apply this special test, or how, in what way, or how you would do it. And the answer I got with that from a man named Dr. Derek Cluley out of Duke University, and at the time he was associated with a large outpatient group, he said, that is a question that would be best answered through fellowship training. And I kind of dismissed it. I thought that was just a sell on the program and trying to get me involved in something else and spending thousands of more dollars on something else that may or may not help me. Well, needless to say, a couple years later, or really probably about 18 months later, I started a fellowship program, specifically a pre-fellowship program, because I was afraid of committing to the full fellowship. And I realized he was exactly right. That is exactly the sort of questions that I wanted to ask, and they were getting answered through that training. And that fellowship lasted about 2 years, during which time, towards the end, I started taking 2-to-1 students ratio, and I realized a whole lot more that I loved the fellowship model. I loved learning, and I loved coaching other physical therapists on things that I felt like I paid a premium for, which was residency and fellowship training, along with a couple other certification tracks. I felt like I could now give a little bit of that knowledge to people that were aspiring to do the same thing and do a good job with it. And I look back and I try and think about, why did I do that? Like, why did that make me feel better? And, you know, was it selfish? Was it fear? Was it pursuit of excellence? Like, what was it? And I think the reality was, I get joy from seeing that other people don't have to go through as much pain or struggle, and they come out the other end with the exact same knowledge that I did. And I think that that was something that was super attractive for me. All the while, and we're talking a whole lot about clinical. And what I would say is, during that time, there was a ton of confusion on whether I wanted to go into the management tree. I was a clinic director in charge of a single location, training to do multi-site location management. I really enjoyed teaching and coaching employees that were on the same boat as me, as well as those around me. I'd like to think that I was a good mentor to individuals around me, and found ways to connect and maybe help them in the same way that I felt helped through some of the education that I went through. And that's when I realized that there was a piece of me that liked teaching, and maybe it was coaching, maybe we call it that. And I started noticing the more that I did that, the more energy that I had. And this is a key point, is when I talk to all of my peers and ask them what my strong suits were, like any good professional on a career track, I ask them for my blind spots and I ask them for my gifts. And consistently, I wasn't sure, but some of my best friends would point that maybe I had a gift in teaching, that people actually listened to things when I talked. And at times, I use that for good, and at times, I use that for evil. And when I say evil, I don't mean like I was doing witchcraft or wizardry or something like that. It's just when I was venting, other people were listening. When I was saying negative things about my career, the progression, the stressors of that individual day, other people were listening, and I was bringing them down. And I would say that that's true for anybody, but for whatever reason, maybe one of my gifts was creating an audience. And I would like to think that, you know, I'm extremely blessed or fortunate for being able to do that. But that was also one of the first times I recognized that I could use my voice and my learning experience in a way that was positive or negative. And so at that point in time, I started to notice more and more often, I kept hearing those voices in the back of my head that like, hey, you're really good at teaching. You're really good at you know, breaking this down several ways to where people can understand it. They want to get on the ship with you. You inspire people. Like, these are good things. And I said, well, I just don't know how they track with management. I just don't know how that works. And it just seemed like maybe I couldn't cut it there. I don't know that that's necessarily the case, but I didn't feel as rewarded in coaching from a career or professional standpoint, with managing, I guess, the day-to-day of operating a clinic, which is obviously a very respectable position. So during all of that time, which these timelines were definitely overlapping, I started to experiment with adjuncting, and I just relocated to Nashville, Tennessee from Athens, Tennessee, and I just put myself out there. So I said that I was willing to adjunct anywhere. I was really interested in teaching to see what I could do, see if I was a fit, and I was excited to teach people that were really excited about learning, and that's what I wanted to, you know, put my eggs in that basket, I would say. So I was fortunate to get or be in the right place at the right time, and I was able to adjunct with somebody who really taught me a lot about the profession in general from early on, which goes as part of my story, is all the way through PT school. The one characteristic that I could say that I had was that I was super curious, and some of my professors absolutely instilled some of that curiosity in me and really pushed me to explore on my own. And for whatever reason, I was just lucky enough to do it. And so through one of those connections, which happened to be APTA Tennessee, which was at the time Tennessee Physical Therapy Association, one of the professors, Dr. Kathy Hinton, was a huge advocate for the profession. And I now realize in teaching psychosocial and some of these other courses is that professional identity is such a huge thing to prevent burnout, to inspire, to be passionate, and really engaged with the career and profession. And so very, very early on, I recognized that in several of my faculty at the University of Tennessee Health Science Center, that would have been Dr. Susan Appling, that would have been pretty much, I would say, in essence, as a whole, the entire faculty was super engaged, had a strong professional identity and sense of team, and I can't dismiss that influence on my career progression. So that's kind of where I started, and I think that that's what drove me from adjuncting. I realized that I liked it more and more, and from that point, it kind of leads me to the next things, which I started getting a little bit more burnt out, not necessarily with the clinic, but just burnt out with, I would say, coaching from a value standpoint of what a clinician's value might actually be, and didn't feel like as rewarded with that. So I started noticing that education was more and more my suit. So from there, I want to talk about kind of what happened before I went for full professorship and what that interview process looked for or looked like. I want to answer some of the questions that came up. So some of the things that some of you may all think and have been wondering is, one, do I need another degree? So do you need another degree, Ryan? And my answer is, CAPT would suggest that your program needs about 50% to have that terminal academic degree or a terminal degree in the field that you're in, which DPT does not satisfy. So you need to be able to adjunct or to be a full professor. You need to show evidence of training beyond the entry level. So that could be board certification, residency training. That could be a terminal degree like a doctorate, like a PhD or DSC. 50% of the faculty need that, and that's okay. So the other 50%, they still need some evidence of training beyond the entry level. So that could be your pediatric specialty. That could be wound care. That could be something else that qualifies you. But I will say that every university is going to be in a different situation. So if you feel a little bit landlocked, if you feel like you need one of these programs, it's probably really important for you to understand what that program is in need of. So for instance, if somebody with a PhD just required or retired and they're requiring a or suggesting another terminal degree, well, that's probably because they need to meet CAPT standards. However, if somebody just gave up a seat and they were more of a, you know, somebody who's got the specialty or something like that, maybe you don't need it. So I think it is important to have those real conversations with the staff or the hiring manager of that program in particular. And I think your odds are a whole lot better if you're flexible with moving around the country in general. So do you need another degree? Not necessarily, but is it helpful? Does it maybe put you on you know, a better scorecard for your interview? I would say absolutely. And I would say maybe even more so with public schools. And we could talk a little bit more about getting grants or funding your salary and things like that in the future. But for now, let's just leave it at, no, you don't need another degree, but you do need evidence of training beyond the entry level. And if you're landlocked and looking at a particular program, it's probably important to start talking to them as soon as possible to see what they project needing in the future. So I've already answered a little bit of the next question, but who were my confidants as I was considering changing my career? I'd say one of my good friends who happened to be very successful in the management side of things. I would go ahead and throw a name out there, Dr. Rob Colosso. He was instrumental in telling me and encouraging me there. I joke now that he was really just trying to clear the way for his own management agenda. But no, he absolutely was one of those people that was whispering in the back of my mind at all times. Another one, Dr. Derek Elmore, are definitely two people that really kind of pushed me there. And, you know, they just mentioned, they were brutally honest with like, hey, you're miserable when you talk about these things and you're really happy when you talk about these. Like, listen to that. Avoid the pitfall of thinking about only a paycheck. And then the question came up also on the boards there is, what do I need on my resume? And the biggest thing I'd say, and we'll kind of decide whether or not we want to elaborate in the future, but teaching experience is key. So wherever you can get that, if that's weekend courses with your local chapter, like APTA Tennessee, if that's adjuncting, if you can get your foot in the door there, or if it's part with your current employer where you're on a continuing education route, maybe you have experience as being a very good CI. Maybe you hold the grand rounds for that location. Maybe you do new graduate orientation. Maybe you've actually designed and implemented several programs. So this can be as little or as extensive as what I was just talking about. So you could, you know, design a course. You could be an adjunct in that course. You could be a teacher's assistant. You could be a fly on the wall. But any teaching experience is key, where you can show that you've understood what a syllabus is, what a course objective is, what it looks like to actually speak in front of other people and to some extent be judged or put to test in front of a group of your peers or potentially other learners. That was a big thing that I didn't realize, is that an online course with an in-person teaching experience is not the same thing. Or a hybrid program, digital learning and digital content might be much, much more valuable to them. So, for instance, for me, while I was considering, you know, the potential move to full professorship, I was serving as a teacher assistant or a lab assistant, a lecturer, and went through that whole progression of trying to get to where I was a full-time faculty and course developer for the company that I was working for and have been working for. And it was kind of working my way up that ladder, which was mostly digital content, online forums, making videos and really assisting in panels and things like that. And I didn't realize how underprepared I probably was with just that knowledge. I recognized that I was much more prepared than probably other people were, but I still felt underprepared. So that takes me into the point where I finally made the decision that academics was the way that I needed to go. And I needed to start think about application and interview. and a few questions came up, and I want to describe just the application process in general. So I would say overall that most of the universities you should look at, in general, you're going to have your research heavy or your teaching heavy institutions. You have public institutions and private institutions. Public and private are going to have a little bit different, I guess, aims in that their money and dollars come from different places, and you need to be aware of that as far as when you're applying. And then the agenda of how many papers do I need to do? What really does my balance between service, scholarship, and teaching look like? So what is the percentage of my day broken down into? Is it half development of research and scholarly agenda? Is it half service? Is it 20%, 10%? And getting a really strong idea for what that looks like. And I'd say for me, I was definitely looking for a teaching institution. I fell into the exact place that I needed to be, and I was super, super lucky to find Belmont. And the interview process, I guess before that, the application process is quite extensive. My quick suggestion would be to make sure your resume is in CAPTI format, and then really highlight the strengths of your resume experience as it relates to the position that's open. So it's great, for instance, that for me, I had a ton of experience in orthopedics. Almost everything that I did was orthopedics. The position that I applied for was not orthopedics, though. It was kind of a mixture of professional issues, management, psychosocial. I'm now in pharmacology, but at the time it was patient care skills, kind of equivalent to PT 101. And foundations, which was what many people would consider physical agents and modalities. So this is in no way, shape, form, or fashion, orthopedics are my very, very, the essence of my practice. It was definitely different, but I knew that I had the strengths in all of those for a variety of reasons. And it was really important to string those together into a logical or coherent pitch or elevator speech as far as what, you know, different passions that I had and how it actually was a perfect lineup for what, you know, my career track had come up to be. So, some other questions that came up about the application is like, you know, what else is there that's necessary and should I get help? I would say definitely look for your friends or mentors that have positions in similar fields. And just recognize that each university is going to be a little bit different, but to some extent, there's going to be something with the mission, vision, values, just like there would be in clinic. And you need to know how to write pretty well, and definitely pay attention to typos, really look at the details, and pay strict attention to structure and syntax and just meaning in general. So, if you make it into the interview process, you know, it's usually several tiers. You normally have a phone interview, just a quick screener. You probably have a group interview at some point, maybe also in a group format over the telephone. And then you have, if you're fortunate enough to make it to in-person interview, that's going to be a whole day of events where you interview basically with every single faculty member or administrative personnel, anybody who's on the team that has value or hiring power will likely speak to you in that day. Also, about every institution is likely to have you do a presentation in front of all of the faculty and likely as many students are available. And they really just want to see what you got. You know, what sort of lecture style do you bring? What sort of technology prowess? What's your design look like? What is your teaching philosophy in action? What's that look like? And that's going to be a huge part of the interview. So I was fortunate to make it through all of those things. And I was, you know, very fortunate to get an offer. And from that, I want to share in the last 5 minutes or so, like, what's it been like since I've been out? And, you know, one of the big questions I get is, do you miss the clinic? And the answer is, and I'd say that this is true of everybody who interviewed me, they said, you know, you're going to experience this this splitting effect where in one hand, you're so happy to be an academic and in just academe, you know, just mindset in general. In the other hand, you're going to feel torn because you feel not relevant. You feel like students don't want to listen to somebody who's not in the clinic, and you feel like you're not in clinic full time. So you're just not getting that sample size. You're not prospecting as often as you had been in the year prior or in the months prior. And so I would say, you know, yes, I miss being in the clinic as much as I used to be. I do not, like any clinician would agree, miss documentation. But what I miss about the clinic the most is probably being up, having conversation, not being inside my own head as much as I am in academics, where I'm just thinking about thinking and thinking about designs and just always in my mind, just thinking about biostatistics and why is this relevant. I miss the action orientation of the clinic and being able to see that result right in front of me rather than waiting for a semester. So in the clinic, you can get results in early or as quick as seconds or minutes or maybe even days or weeks. Whereas in university, you're likely not to get results on your effort except for every semester, every year. And you don't get a chance to redo it the next day or the next week. You've got to wait an entire year to redo that same lesson a year later. So that's what I miss most about the clinic, I would say. Another question came from the field. Do I think that teaching is hard? And the answer is absolutely yes. I think that teaching is very hard. I didn't even understand what the word pedagogy was when I was orienting to academics in general. I didn't really understand it, but now I have such a deeper respect for the amount of time, effort, and energy that goes into a unique design for a course. Like, why did one thing, if we just take it from the design of the syllabus, like that is a hard document to create. If you look at it when you're a student, you don't really appreciate it. And you're like, oh, this is nice. A lot of jargon. I don't really care. Let me look at the schedule. Where are my breaks? And as an instructor, I would say that I really wanted the language to be purposeful. I wanted the design to be purposeful. I wanted it to be a roadmap. And oftentimes I felt like I was falling short. And then just from there, a single PowerPoint. Being able to organize it, it gave me nightmares, very similar to the ACT in prioritizing your syntax or your paragraph structure to answer a question after an essay or a prompt. It's very much the same way with designing a PowerPoint. And then there's all the technology that goes with that. Like, how can I be relevant for my students? How can I make this attractive? How can I be engaging through a technology like PowerPoint or Prezi? And beyond that, which lecture should come next? How can I scaffold or really build upon the previous one? How can I intensify learning? How can I be meaningful? How can I come across as an ally? How can I make students, not necessarily make them learn, but how can I be designing things in the best way to help people learn? And I think that those are the insecurities that you have as a teacher. Another question I get is, what does your day look like? You know, I'm obviously not teaching from 8 to 5, like sitting there speaking to an audience, unless it's a weekend course, which I do have some involvement with. But most of the time, your day is looking like stewing over the things that I just talked about. Is how can I design this? How can I orchestrate this perfectly to achieve the learning objectives? And not this superficial learning. Like, I want people to be good clinicians. I want my family that goes to see these therapists in the future to be proud, to be confident in their therapist. Like, how do I produce a person, a professional capable of delivering on that? And that's what I think about. And I try and design slides, text, the perfect size, the animation to burn it into your brain, the graphic to really hook into you, the 2-minute pitch at the beginning to hook you, the conclusion, the summative comments, the assignments. How can I do that to really capture the essence of physical therapy? That's what my day typically looks like outside of lecturing. Another fun question is, how do I put up with the students in those classes, the ones that maybe don't appear outwardly to respect or consider that I've gone through that level of detail to make sure that they're learning, that their tuition dollars are put to good use. And the answer is, you put up with students the same way as you put up with people or just your patients in general. It's like everybody's unique. It's a relationship that you have to navigate two ways, and you're trying to connect as many people as you can at any given time. And you need to be able to put yourself in their shoes. The difference between clinic and in the classroom is going to be that you have typically one or two or three patients at a time. You're dividing attention one, two, or three ways, and you're communicating maybe with three different styles in that hour block or half hour block, whatever you're doing. Whereas in the classroom, you're likely trying to really teach to the majority, and you want to put some things in there for some folks that maybe have different learning styles, but you can't, and you have to be able to cope with that. And that's something that all teachers struggle with, is not being able to make everybody happy. And, you know, feeling that, just like that patient who doesn't get well, you feel like the students that you fail to connect with or fail to help, you know, achieve the learning objectives for that content, you feel like it's that patient who got away. And so I would say that that's the similarity to clinic life. And got a question, are teachers really out there to get you, like to really bounce you out of the program, to fail you? And I would say I've never had a conversation with somebody with that's a teacher that wants to get you. They want to help you learn. They want so badly for all of the things that you want to be there, and they want to design it that way. And they try to. And some may seem like their agendas are mixed, but I have never had a conversation where somebody's out to get somebody. Now, there are times where I know somebody's maybe said something that I didn't know how to take personally and professionally. I didn't know if it was disrespectful, if I needed to be a disciplinarian, if I needed to gently guide. I didn't know what to do, but never was I trying to get even or get back at somebody, I would say. So that's really what teachers are thinking. It's like, how can I make and sharpen the best possible physical therapist? How can I please, for the love of God, not make this a boring lesson and to be able to inspire and make passionate professionals? Like, how can I do that? I don't want a boring class. I don't want to be the person known as having boring classes. How can I be somebody who can relate to my audience in a way that inspires them for not just that day, but the rest of their careers? I think about, what are my gifts and how do I use them to best serve the people around me? Very similar to the way that I was in clinic. I think about that all the time, and it takes a ton of energy, and it keeps me up at night for sure, thinking about how I can really sharpen the saw or just be a little bit better next time, or explain where some of my realized deficits were. And I think all in all, I kind of want to summarize this by saying that there seems to be a struggle between academics and clinical life in general. There is no perfect balance. The one reason that I definitely love academics is I get the chance to be a coach, a mentor, a physical therapist, and I still practice. The role is a little bit reversed. Instead of clinic most of the time, academics sometime. It's academics most of the time and clinic sometime. But I feel like at this stage and juncture in my life, that's the perfect balance. I do see that it seems that clinicians either view academics as maybe people that burnt out in the real world or lost their willingness to be a clinician, or were too good or considered themselves to be too good. Maybe they were too bright, too talented to be in the clinic, and they need to be, you know, a gift somewhere else. And I wouldn't say that that's necessarily the case. And I'd say that on the opposite side, like, what do academics think about clinicians? A lot of them have trouble like fathoming, like, or even trying to understand what clinicians go through. Like I would say that you lose touch with that very, very quickly. And there's a real struggle, but both groups can help each other a ton. And I'd like to see that through. So That's a real quick answer of all the questions that I got about my story. I would love to elaborate on a little bit more, and maybe I'll do a little mini series on this, but hopefully it gives you some insight into what a teacher or a professor might be actually thinking and where they came from. These are not just super talented clinicians that just made it because they were excellent teacher savants, just super gifted, super intelligent. It all starts with caring. And these clinicians care a ton and they want to pay it forward. And that's how they become academics. I would say that everybody's got a healthy curiosity. And that's kind of where we're at. So I'd love to hear your comments coming forward. I'm really thankful that I got a chance to do this monologue style. I'm not the most organized person in the world. Hopefully I can get some feedback from y'all. And I'll look forward to sharing more with you in the future. So again, thanks for hosting me. And that's all for this episode of Spilling the DPT. If you like this episode, please feel free to drop us a review and subscribe for Endless Tea and follow me on Instagram at Spilling the DPT. We are found where all good podcasts live: Spotify, Apple, Stitcher, Deezer, Pandora, TuneIn, Amazon, iHeartRadio, and Google Podcasts. We look forward to spilling with you all next time.